Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. Reminder, we Zoom on Tuesday, so if something happens on Tuesday night, like elections in Kentucky and New York, we will not be commenting on them. But actually, that will be interesting to see what actually happens in Kentucky. Will Amy McGrath pull it out? We'll have to ask our first guest. Anyway, we begin our show by sharing with you the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman. He testified during the impeachment hearings of 2019. I keep thinking, if you want to understand what a definition of patriot is, you look at Lieutenant Colonel Vindman. If you want to know what the opposite of that is, you look at Mr. Bolton. That's all I have to say. I'm just, in a way, the fact that I'm celebrating Vindman is just so appropriate, as Bolton, you know, is looking to make money and never testified, knowing so much that it would fill a book and produce lots of provocative information. But when did he decide to reveal it? Now and not then. All right, stick around for the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
The American Prospect is one of my favorite reads. I love their new, by the way, I love your new executive editor, David Dayan. I don't think he ever sleeps. He's so prolific. It's just amazing. And I think he has a new book out called Monopoly. When did he have time to write that? But I wanted to ask you, because who we have right now on the air is Harold Meyerson. Harold Meyerson is the editor at large at the American Prospect. And I believe you and Bob Kuttner are really kind of like the founding fathers. Am I correct?
I'm not a founding father. I came in 2001, but Bob Kuttner, Paul Starr, and Robert Reich founded the magazine in 1990.
Wow.
Really?
Yeah.
Yep. And you're still going, so congratulations.
Still going, and Bob and Paul are still going, and Robert Reich is doing great writing out in Berkeley, where he's a professor now.
Well, it's always a pleasure to have Harold on the air. There is so much on our plate that we can talk about. We can talk about Tulsa. We can talk about COVID-19. We can talk about the elections that are happening today in Kentucky and New York, which I really do want to touch on. But you wrote a really interesting, very sort of short blog piece about Justice Roberts. And Justice Roberts last week was involved in two of the majority decisions. One, the shocking one, which was 6-3, about LGBTQ rights, and then the decision about DACA. And you reminded us that, one, he was appointed by George Bush, and that to a large extent, he kind of really represents a Bush appointment. He's kind of a Bush Republican appointment. Explain that to my audience, because I think you're absolutely right, but I think we've actually forgotten what that means.
Well, let's look at those two decisions and then look at some of his other rulings. George W. Bush, who appointed him, having been governor of Texas back in the days when xenophobia wasn't the primary ideology of the Republican Party, was in favor of immigration reform. And John Roberts' decision not to allow the Trump administration to dispose of DACA was, I think, in keeping with the sort of broader ethos of the Republican Party of George W. Bush. On the LGBT decision, which was remarkable and historic, on the one hand, when he ran for re-election in 2004, under the guidance of good old Karl Rove, George Bush did make a big issue about opposition to gay marriage. But, you know, it's always been the Republican establishment, the old establishment, has always been much more comfortable with gay rights than it has with other folks' rights, largely because gays pop up in their own family, you know, and the same cannot be said for Mitt Romney's 47%, by definition, which includes most American racial minorities. So that's on the one hand. On the other hand, remember that voter suppression hardly began with Donald Trump. It's been going on for a long time. And it was John Roberts who delivered this devastating decision in Shelby County versus Holder back in 2013, which essentially suspended the Voting Rights Act. And that has led to all of these outrages in states, particularly in the South, that would have federal monitoring that would be stopping them from whacking hundreds of thousands of minority voters off the voting rolls and things like that. This is the John Roberts, who is a George W. Bush Republican in a negative sense. Let's remember that John Roberts, the much younger lawyer, actually was one of the people who worked for Papa Bush, old man Bush, for George W. Bush in 2000 during the contested post-election election in Florida. He went down there. Republican Supreme Court justices have a history of wanting to suppress voting. I mean, if we go back to William Rehnquist, there is a good deal of testimony that way back in 1964, when Goldwater, in the years of Goldwater's rise, he was challenging minority voters in Arizona, where he lived at the time. So there is the John W. Roberts, who is pro-corporate, anti-labor, for limiting the franchise, and that's a George W. Bush Republican.
You're absolutely right. And we were just talking last week about a very interesting race in North Carolina, and part of the reason why there's an interesting race is they had to reconfigure the districts because the North Carolina Supreme Court basically found partisan gerrymandering unconstitutional under the North Carolina Constitution. And what is my favorite part of that whole decision in North Carolina is that they make fun of the United States Supreme Court not being able to find partisan egregious gerrymandering and said, watch us, we can do it and you can't. And right. In part, that's Justice Roberts.
There's that famous line from a Supreme Court justice on the difficulty of defining what is pornographic. He says, I'll know it when you see it. John Roberts' line towards gerrymandering is, I don't know it even if you parade it in front of my face. The Supreme Court under Roberts has refused to enforce the kind of voting rights that come with fairly apportioned, fairly line-drawn congressional districts. So it falls back to the state Supreme Courts to do what's obvious, which is calling a gerrymander a gerrymander.
If I may just put in perspective, because you talked quite accurately about Roberts's opinion in Shelby County and how it essentially eviscerated the Voting Rights Act. And that was in the context of talking about voter suppression. But just to put that in context, before that decision, the Voting Rights Act required the southern states that had long history, and some districts in the north, that had long histories of racial, not only suppression, but racial oppression. They didn't let people even vote. But they had to pre-clear, according to the Voting Rights Act 1965, those states had to pre-clear any changes to their voting method through the Justice Department Civil Rights Division. And when I worked there, I wasn't in the section that reviewed them, but they reviewed, the effects of you enact this kind of a new procedure and blacks are gonna be excluded and suppressed. And so you can't do it. And as soon as Shelby County came down, and these states did not have to pre-clear their changes, they just started making all these incredibly racially discriminatory changes that resulted in voter suppression here and voter suppression there. And
wasn't one of the rationales that it's okay, we've gone beyond that now. Yeah. We don't do that kind of behavior. And yet within 48 hours after the decision, they literally did all that behavior. They proved the opposite.
And you put that in the context of today, where there's all these racial, everybody now knows that racism is systemic and rampant.
But, you know, the other aspect of what Roberts and the conservative justices did with Shelby County is they overturned a law which had been renewed virtually unanimously by the Congress only shortly before then. So you talk about judicial activism.
Yeah.
In this case, the impact of the what Roberts was sort of saying is I don't see a problem even where the Congress overwhelmingly sees a problem. So, you know, I mean, his the empirical basis for saying we're past this it certainly wasn't widely shared. And as you said, Arnie, was immediately evident within 48 hours of that decision.
It's still shocking because it was kind of like, I was like, I wanted to hold the mirror up and go, excuse me, boys, you see what they're doing? It's just like, maybe you should go back and rewrite this. Anyway, since we're talking about voting, let's talk what's going on in Kentucky, for example, in New York. Sure. And not just about the fact that they only have like one voting place for 600,000 people, which is just unconscionable. But I also want to talk about who's running in New York, who's running in Kentucky, because there's a really interesting article at the American Prospect that this is kind of one of really the first election after George Floyd. And I think that that's actually a line of demarcation. We have a higher sense of overt racism. We have a higher sense of what has happened to African Americans. It's almost like this is a tipping point, and these two races are happening right at that tipping point.
Well, more than two, because New York has a whole series of primaries right today that are all kind of very interesting post-George Floyd and pre-George Floyd. Kentucky, though, this clearly is, in some ways, the first election of the post-George Floyd period, as my young colleague Alex Salmon wrote at The Prospect. Allison McGrath has been the favored candidate of Chuck Schumer and the Democratic Senate Campaign Committee, or Amy McGrath, since forever. She narrowly lost a House race in 2018, and they decided that she, who's sort of a relative centrist on some issues, certainly not in the mainstream of the Democratic Party, former Marine pilot, would be the best shot at unseating Mitch McConnell, who is fairly unpopular in the state, no matter who he runs against. Then, in the George Floyd period, since the killing of a woman on whom police broke into her house and shot her eight times, turned out to be a friend of a state legislator, an African-American state legislator, who was also running in the primary, Charles Booker. And with the mobilizations around Floyd and this killing in Louisville.
Yeah, Taylor.
Yeah, Ms. Taylor. Booker started getting more attention, rising in the polls, endorsed by national progressives like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Also by the main newspaper in Louisville, who found Schumer's candidate sort of vapid, and has really come on strong. Now, Schumer's candidate had $41 million in the bank, and Booker had about zero. He's since his candidacy has caught fire, been able to put together last minute funding. They're both up on TV. And when the Democrats go to the polls today, we'll see what happens. Now, clearly, McGrath had a massive lead. No one ever heard of this guy out of his district up until, you know, 3-4 weeks ago. But there's no question that lead has diminished. In some polls, she leads by high single digits. There's one poll where he leads. We shall see what happens.
So I need to tell you, I feel very proud of myself, Harold. Before all of this happened, I actually did an interview with a reporter who had gone down to Kentucky and met Booker. And he wrote a really, really interesting piece. And I called him up and I said, I want to know about this guy. I know about Amy McGrath, but who is this guy? And he goes, you better watch him, Arn. Like, he's articulate. He's a go-getter. He knows Kentucky. He has a great story to tell. You're going to be surprised at how talented he is as a politician. He says, I don't know where he's going to go with that, given he's running against, you know, Amy, who has the entire Democratic establishment, and as you pointed out, more money than God. But so I was following him. And then, of course, we see what's happened now. And it really is kind of both exciting and shocking, because let's understand, we saw an election like that in the state of New Hampshire. We had a woman named Carol Shea Porter. Carol Shea Porter won in my state. She raised Zippo. And I remember when I went down to talk to her about, like, so what's your game plan and how are you going to raise money? And she said, my game plan. And she literally did this. She pulled a book from under her chair. She handed me the book, and the book was The Tipping Point. And she said, I am at a tipping point. I will win. And I kind of rolled my eyes and got in the car and went, okay. And then, of course, Congresswoman Carol Shea Porter is, you know, that's the rest of the story. So he is at a very interesting inflection point.
He is. And we shall see where this goes. Now, obviously, Mitch McConnell is as entrenched as any politician could be. He's running for his seventh term. He is widely unpopular in the state. And it's not clear whether his entrenchment will outweigh his unpopularity. The theory behind McGrath was that, well, she could win swing voters, and that's what Chuck Schumer was looking at. The theory behind Booker is that he excites people, which had not been the case for McGrath, that he can bring younger and minority voters to the polls who might not otherwise vote. And either way, Kentucky is looking like an interesting, complicated political state come November. It's a state that Trump carried in 2016 by more than 20%. So it's by no means a liberal state, but who knows? And this time, what might happen? And if anyone personifies the swamp that needs to be drained, that swamp looks a hell of a lot like Mitch McConnell from any known angle.
Yeah, Moscow Mitch. I love that name, yeah, Moscow yeah. Mitch. So let's touch on Tulsa, because you also wrote a very interesting piece about Tulsa. So here's what I'm trying to figure out. Was this something that is going to sort of send a message to our president that, you know, this is a very different time, and the game plan of 2016 really needs to be rethought? Because if you listen to his, I don't know how long, 2-hour speech, it was more about Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama than it was about Joe Biden. There was nobody in the audience, which had to be incredibly depressing. And what was so surprising is they could have social distance in that building, because there were only 6,000 of them in a building that held 19,000. They could each have had their own personal row, practically. But of course, that's not how it operates. And I'm looking at what happened in Tulsa, and I'm thinking that it is exciting from my perspective. But I'm wondering, is it an early warning to him? And can he read the political tea leaves, or is he not capable of doing that?
I don't think he's capable of doing that. I think it is an early warning to other Republicans that they are tied to this guy, and he is probably going to be an anchor who lead them all to a descent into the deep. I don't think Trump has it in him. I mean, what can he reassess? His everything by him is personal. He's still committed, for instance, to when a case comes. Another case comes before the Supreme Court in the early fall to repeal Obamacare. Yet again, Bill Barr's Justice Department, at Trump's direction, is going to be arguing for repealing it in the midst of a health crisis. I mean, that says to me that the guy's head is irretrievably stuck in essentially personal grievances. Trump doesn't take in experience the way, in a sense, the way normal people at their best take in experience. He listens to Fox News in the morning, that sort of stuff. And since they have as blinkered a view of the world as he does, they only reinforce all of his self-absorbed biases and prejudices. So I don't think we're going to see any shift in strategy. And, you know, he also, has really no, he's not said anything about what he would do during a second term other than continue to appoint right-wing judges.
So it's not about what he would do.
Yeah, Harold, I know.
He doesn't do anything.
Let
me just say something. We had a guy on who's teaching in the UK. And so we're sort of learning about his experience. And I said to him, talk to me about Boris Johnson. Because everyone keeps saying that Boris Johnson is kind of like, you know, Donald Trump. Bad hair, bombastic, you know, can embrace life, yada, yada. He goes, well, there's a lot to be true about that. He said, but here's the difference. Boris Johnson actually governs.
Yeah.
It's like there are things he does that are pull your hair out, but he actually governs. He gets governing. You know, you may disagree with him about some of the things, but Donald Trump doesn't have that governing capacity.
He doesn't have a governing capacity, and he doesn't have a philosophy that he's seeking to enact except self-aggrandizement, which won't get you ultimately very far. I mean, there's still circumstances under which he might be able to carry the Electoral College in November, but, you know, a list of his achievements would be a blank page other than the tax cut for the rich.
Well, to me, that's a Biden man.
And the judges.
And the judges, yes.
That's a legacy. That's a big one.
The judges are as much McConnell as they are Trump. It's let them share the blame for this.
All right. So before I let you go, so there was the Friday night massacre with Berman and Barr, and I don't know what's going on. I mean, I'm just trying to figure out is Barr a little bit like Trump in the sense that because I have the power, I can use it? I mean, it's like, I'm not sure why you're using it. What was the point other than to make everyone apoplectic? And in the end, whatever he wanted to get, he didn't get, because Berman's replacement is going to be the number two in command, who is very much like Berman in that way.
Yeah. He's interim, so I suppose this only makes sense if gets a second term. But obviously, he was getting the prosecutor, Burns was getting too close to people in Trump's orbit. And Bill Barr got the word that he had to go. And Barr sort of fumfered it. But then it became clear that it had to come from Trump himself, and it came from Trump himself. Barr certainly represents kind of a new low in attorneys general. I mean, John Mitchell had previously, I guess, held that title for being one of the men behind Watergate. Nothing like an attorney general who sanctions political break-ins. But Barr, in his own way, what John Mitchell was doing wasn't, in a sense, rooted in criminality, but not authoritarianism. Whereas what Barr does, kind of gets into both. He a more versatile scoundrel than John Mitchell in that regard.
And let me ask a question. So we know that Trump seems to be in a place by himself in the Republican spectrum. How many of the Barr types are there out there? Because I'm looking at the Lincoln Project and all the anti-Trumpers, and they're as disgusted with Barr as they are with Trump. And I'm just wondering, where is the Barr ilk?
Well, I mean, the Barr ilk is part of the Trump ilk, and the Trump ilk has considerable backing. Now, one of the interesting things, as you mentioned with the Lincoln Project and other things, is the rising number of principal conservatives who've had it with not just Trump, but people like Barr and the entire Republican Congress. And someone who's gone after the entire Republican Congress is, of all people, George Will, who continues to write, none of these people should be reelected. The Republican Party needs to be cleansed. And so, the Bolton book is this mishmash of self-interest and, hey, this guy is deviating from, my notion of Republican ideology. Well, of course Trump deviates. Trump's notion of Republican ideology boils down to what's good for Donald Trump, which is obviously going to leave some conservatives, both principled and unprincipled, in distress.
Wow.
You mentioned John Roberts in the same context that you mentioned George Will.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, they're both sort of these Republican people who have an interest in the institutions maintaining their viability, their credibility, legitimacy.
Yes, they are. And, you know, that's one of the things where Roberts, I think, is highly conscious of. I would expect he will not go along with the Trump request to keep his tax returns secret. On the other stuff that's coming up before the court, I think we need to batten down the hatches, because my fear is that that'll be pretty bad.
And on that note, I need to let Harold Meyerson go. He is the editor at large at the American Prospect, one of my favorite reads. So much to talk about, but there isn't anything Harold hasn't thought about. Thank you so much for joining me, Harold Meyerson.
Thank you, Arnie. It's always a pleasure.
All right, stick around, everyone. When we come back, we're going to be talking about what has happened since the course of time from slavery to today to African Americans, and sort of the disinvestment in their opportunity and their ability to accumulate wealth. I'll be right back.
Tired, 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 tired. I am the wife of a black man, the mother of a young black man, and the daughter and sister of a black man. And I'm tired of the injustice going on. Tired worrying when my son lay gone. Oh, wondering what's going on.
Welcome back to part two of the Wednesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arnison and the producer, Ken Barnes. So, conversation.com, you got to go check it out. It's all over the world now. Fabulous writing, great professors, great PhD candidates, really, really excellent content. So I'm looking at the conversation, and I see this article, Black Americans, Crucial Workers in Crises, Emerge Worse Off, Not Better. Joining me right now is the author of that piece, Calvin Schmermerhorn. He's a professor of history at Arizona State University. He teaches courses on African American history, capitalism, and slavery. He is the author of a book entitled Unrequited Toil, A History of the United States Slavery. But the book I can't wait for, Calvin, is your new book, The Plunder of Black America, How the Racial Gap Was Made and Why It's Growing. He will be a Fulbright Senior Scholar in the UK in 2021. Let me welcome Calvin to the program. How are you, Calvin?
Thank you for having me. Wonderful.
So, you know, after I realized what your new book is, I suddenly realized, you know what this article is? It's your Cliff Notes. Because yeah. This article is phenomenal. Because it just went from the very beginning, and you just did this timeline. And reading the timeline of what has happened to Black Americans, it's exhausting and depressing, and we have never been taught it, Calvin. We don't know our history. And your book and this article is a must read now, because I think as we're at this moment isn't surprising. It's so overdue.
Yes. The logic of this argument is that in every national crisis, African-descended Americans have been disproportionately, essential workers have responded in disproportionate numbers. But then after each crisis, the kind of reforms that happen tend to set African-American earners back relative to whites. And so if we look back at the last 155 years since the Civil War, we can see this repeatedly. After World War I, after World War II, in the Vietnam era, and of course, most recently this year, during the coronavirus crisis and the economic turmoil we're all in.
So let's start with the Civil War, because that's where you start. So I want people to hear the timeline. I want people to hear the contribution, the expectation, and then what happened after the result. So they put the toil in, they put the effort in, and yet the consequence of this is not to recognize the value of what they do, but to actually say thank you and then go back to white America and say, look at this enhanced opportunity.
Right. So if we look at Black participation in the Civil War, African Americans were only about 1% of the Northern population, yet they were 25% of the Union Navy, 10% of the Union Army. And it was really African-descended Americans who freed themselves in the Civil War. They didn't wait around for the Congress to grow a conscience or even the president to decide that the emancipation was the order of the war. And so what we just witnessed in Juneteenth is a celebration of that fact. But then after freedom came, you had this abortive attempt to redistribute land. First with General William Tecumseh Sherman's Special Order 15 in 1865, the famous 40 acres and a mule. This was supposed to redistribute land that enslaved people were working, had worked for generations, based on the fact that they were loyal participants in restoring the Union and guaranteeing freedom. Well, that was rescinded by President Andrew Johnson. There was also an effort in Congress in 1867 to pass a Reparations Act that would also redistribute land. At the same time, we saw really staunch retrenchment of just about every facet of slavery except slave owning in many parts of the South. And so—
Explain what you mean by that, because I think that's really important, because in a lot of ways, what we've seen now, for example, with the prison population, where there are more African Americans in prison than there were slaves during, you know, before the Civil War. But explain what happened, because in part they were re-enslaved, only they used a different terminology.
Right. So we've got an emancipation in 1865. 4 million enslaved people are now free by law. They represented 20% of national wealth before the war in terms of the value of slave property. This is now gone off the books thanks to the Civil War and emancipation. But what states in the former Confederacy did was to pass Black codes or laws specifically targeting African Americans that imposed fines and often severe fines for being unemployed. The Mississippi legislature passed a Vagrancy Act in 1865 that punished just about anything. It said all rogues and vagabonds, idle and dissipated persons, beggars, jugglers, persons practicing unlawful games or plays, runaways, common drunkards, common nightwalkers, pilferers, ... people who misspend their time by frequenting houses of ill fame could be fined, could be imprisoned. They said all Black people 18 years or older who are found unemployed after the second Monday in 1866 would be fined and imprisoned. And so they're trying to force African-descended people back to work as a way to control labor and to do what Southerners had done in the last 50 years before the Civil War, which was that each time they found themselves in crisis, to force African-Americans to grow more cotton, do the work. And so this was in the immediate aftermath of the war. Now, the Civil Rights Act of 1866 said absolutely not. You cannot pass this sort of discriminatory legislation. Mm-hmm. Congress took over Reconstruction. But then the rules of the game changed slightly, because even though the former enslavers lost their labor, they did not lose their land. They did not lose their privilege of allocating credit. And so what we had was a transition to widespread sharecropping, which is essentially renting something based on promising half or some proportion of the harvest. But this tended to trap Black people in poverty because it perpetuated debts. So you'd have to borrow for the seed, borrow for borrow for the food, borrow for the clothing, borrow for everything you needed. And at the end of the year, you owed 125% of the harvest. This took, this essentially engrafted children onto these agreements too. So you had widespread unpaid child labor supporting this. And so this was grinding intergenerational poverty. And if we're looking at the racial wealth gap, which is what sociologists call the disparity between what the typical white family earns and the typical Black family owns, then what we can see are the roots of this ever since Reconstruction.
You know, it's interesting because I was reading an article by a group of Black economists out in California, and they were talking about the 2008 economic meltdown. And that basically the people that were probably the most devastated by that were African Americans. And that even today in 2020, the people that are still the most devastated by the 2008 economic meltdown are African Americans who saw the vast amount of their wealth just completely disappear, and they have not been able to regroup. At one point, one of the articles I read was talking about these incredibly creative, like mortgage products. And one of the mortgage products they were talking about was a product known as liar loans. And that 35% of African Americans that lost their homes during that 2008 economic meltdown lost their homes. Why? Because of liar loans. And you have to ask, you know, even by what it's called, you feel like you almost know who the target audience was.
Yes. Right. If we fast forward from the Reconstruction era to the boom times right before the 2008 meltdown, we did see this predatory lending. Yeah. There's a really good book on this subject that goes back to the 1960s to trace the origins of it. It's called Race for Profit by Kianga Yamada Taylor, professor at Princeton. The subtitle is How Banks and the Real Estate Industry Undermined Black Homeownership. So what you had in the early 20th century was what we commonly call redlining. That is, the government decided not to guarantee any loans given to residents of Black, Latinx, Jewish neighborhoods, but especially African-American neighborhoods. And so it essentially creates a problem that didn't exist before, which is a disinvestment in areas in which most African-American people lived, at the same time as stunning investments in wealthier white neighborhoods, middle-class suburbs, a whole range of housing that became the basis of the modern middle class right after World War II. And so this gave white America a huge intergenerational advantage in terms of passing down the value of homes to the next generation. And then all the equity that was built up in them that people could borrow against for college educations, for improvements, and then all the collateral benefits that were bundled together in suburbs, including good, you know, public health, excellent education, a real escalator into the middle class. And when you think about the middle of the 20th century, when a good blue collar job could pay the mortgage, pay for cars, pay for the hopes and dreams of the next generation, generations of African Americans missed out on that in large part because of housing discrimination. So if we have the civil rights era and that housing discrimination becomes illegal based on the Fair Housing Act of 1968, what happens then? Well, predatory inclusion.
Stop. That word I had never heard before. I mean, it makes sense now. But so if you can't get them through redlining, now you're coming up with these creative products. We know that they did. And the idea of predatory inclusion. Explain to my audience that term of art, because I had never heard it before, but now I completely understand it.
Yeah, predatory inclusion. This is, again, Kianga Yamada Taylor and other scholars. This is essentially reverse redlining. That is, you take people who are traditionally excluded from loans, and then you target them for predatory lending as a way to address historic discrimination. And so in this case, in post-redlining Detroit, lending companies targeted Black borrowers they thought could not pay back the loans, that these loans were also federally guaranteed. And so they got two benefits. They got people who lost their property due to foreclosure. And so they could turn those homes over, resell them or gentrify them. And then they'd get they wouldn't lose any money because the federal government had backed the loans. And so this is the definition of predatory inclusion. And so
Go on. I thought part of the predatory inclusion is not only, so they go from redlining where they won't give you a mortgage to now basically selling you a mortgage that they kind of know you can't really repay. Like they set you up to, really, you know what predatory inclusion is? It's setting you up to fail. And they want you to fail because one, they've got the federal guarantee. Two, they lose nothing. The only one who loses is the person who actually was given the mortgage.
Right. And this is connected to kind of structural racism, because since the late 19th century, at least, and this is based on the research of Paige Glotzer at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and others, the real estate industry has really equated Black ownership with lower property values and a decline in property values. And so this poisonous, this racist attitude pervaded the real estate and banking industries. And so you almost by the culture of this process have discriminatory banking, discriminatory lending on top of discriminatory practices in housing, you know, regulations that put Black borrowers at a disadvantage. So in the housing bubble that preceded the 2008 crisis, you had lending companies that would steer Black borrowers into subprime loans regardless of income and regardless of neighborhood. So you get things like the 2012 Wells Fargo settlement for $150 million, where they admitted nothing wrong, but the accusation was that Black and Latinx borrowers paid higher fees and paid higher interest and had other penalties. And so in the 2008 crisis, it wasn't as if the value of homes in Black and Latinx neighborhoods, you know, the absolute value fell farther. It was that borrowers who are already paying higher fees, paying higher interest, who had less equity in their home, went underwater when the market crashed, whereas many white borrowers had mechanisms that helped bail them out.
My brother is a banker, and my brother kind of blames the Democrats for what happened to the African American community with what you were just describing. And he said, well, they told us that we needed to basically rectify the redlining, that we needed to make sure that these African Americans were able to sort of buy more homes and have access to a mortgage and yada, yada, yada. And they celebrated the number of increases in Black home ownership. And now you're blaming us for what happened because of the 2008 economic meltdown. But again, if you understand that what the financial community did was they just, as you point out, they went from one extreme to the other. But the fact is the extremes were by definition a target of failure for the African-American community, who basically were losing either way.
Right. Correct. Oh. Yeah. Oh. Right. And I guess the response could be that nobody asked the banking industry to develop home mortgage products that were predatory. I mean, this was now there's some debate there, because there were government agencies like Housing and Urban Development and the Federal Housing Administration before that was responsible for all this redlining and discrimination and had a big part in it. But that doesn't get lenders off the hook, I don't think. I mean, another part of this is the banking industry as a whole. African Americans have historically been underbanked. That is, that banking facilities have been off limits. And so if you're wealthy, banks are crawling, trying to line up to give you free checking accounts and all kinds of perks and all the rest of it.
To come invest with them. Yeah.
Right. Correct. And so the cost of banking, if you are not in that segment, is very high proportionally. And so you have predatory lending. This is something that happened after the Civil War. In 1865, Congress chartered the Freedmen's Bank. It was a wonderfully conceived institution. It was supposed to collect the deposits of African-American citizens who would then have bank accounts for the first time ever. It would make loans to Black businesses. In practice, it didn't. In practice, it made loans to white businesses. And then during the 1873 financial panic, the bank slipped and in 1874 went bankrupt. It took a huge proportion of Black wealth with it. And then if you look at the subsequent history in the scholarship of people like Jeanette Garrett Scott and Mercer Baradaran, Black banks have really suffered from segregation. You can't segregate a banking industry and expect that the kind of separate and yet unequal Black banking institutions are going to be able to reverse the structural racism. And so you see this as well. This kind of compounds the problem.
So let's fast forward to the end of your article. Again, everyone, you need to go to theconversation.com. I can't wait for your book to come out. We're going to have to get you back, and you'll have to sort of share more of that book. And I hope you get on all those shows so you can talk about it. The article is Black Americans, Crucial Workers in Crises Emerge Worse Off, Not Better. He starts us with the Civil War. He's going to take us right now to what's happening now with the pandemic. But I want to remind everyone that Calvin Schmermerhorn is going to be a Fulbright senior scholar in the UK in 2021. They're going to be lucky to have you, Calvin. So take us to today. So today, what we do know is obviously where I do feel like we're at a tipping point. And we were saying that with Harold Meyerson from the American Prospect. But what we've been seeing, in fact, this is something Royal Ford said yesterday, Ken Barnes, that what has happened as a result of the pandemic is that it's unmasked all the failure. It has begun to expose what's happened because so many African Americans have lost their lives, have contracted COVID. They're the ones that have lost a significant amount of wealth. They're the frontline workers who are being put in positions where their health is threatened. So talk to us again about this, because I don't want all the same patterns that we've seen since the Civil War to happen again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and we hear a lot about structural racism, and this isn't a series of attitudes, it's a series of practices that reinforce one another. And this is exactly what was exposed in the COVID-19 crisis. So before the crisis, there was a wealth gap in the United States that was about 1 to 10 and 1 to 13. That is, the typical white family has 13 times the wealth as a typical black family. So what this means is that, for example, you don't necessarily have multi-generational families living together. The old folks can go to the skilled care unit. The nuclear family can go and pursue their jobs and such. And also that sort of wealth and privilege over time has meant entry into tech and finance and so many of those good rewarding careers. So what we saw in the coronavirus crisis is that so many African Americans are essential workers, right, who are making crucial deliveries, who are in healthcare, who are either doctors or handing out masks or exposed, and more black physicians serve at-risk communities than others. So we had people who were on the front lines, and then paradoxically, many of those positions, let's say they're Amazon delivery drivers, do not have a lot of job security. And so you're asking people to risk their health, risk their safety, oftentimes for a low wage with very little job security. And then what we see then is, since we have more families living together, there's more
chance,
more risk of exposure, correct. And so 30% of cases, and I believe 40% of deaths, were African American.
You look at Chelsea in Boston, and you see a story of exactly what you just described. My friend who works in New York City, she works in downtown, but she lives out in the Bronx, and she sent me a series of pictures. You will love them, Calvin. And what the picture was that when she first got on the subway, at the very beginning, it was packed full of people, mostly African American and Hispanic. As she got more into the sort of yada yada downtown, the subway got emptier and emptier and emptier. And there was like maybe 4 or 5 people on the subway. Mm-hmm. Virtually all of them were wearing masks. And then by the time she said it was like the story of life. The people that had to go to work, the people that couldn't stay home, the people that couldn't, isolate, they were packing the subway. And then as you got to a place where more of the financial markets were, and Fifth Avenue was, all of a sudden, the subway just basically emptied out. And it kind of told visually the story you're describing.
Yeah, perfect and tragic illustration of it. And so if we're looking ahead to what's the recovery looking like, is it going to be those individuals who risk so much? Are they gonna get anything more than the $1,200 check if they're lucky? Are they going to get extensions on healthcare? Or are we still going to see a mad dash to repeal the Affordable Care Act to make things harder for working people, when we see the $500 billion in what I think Paul Krugman even called a campaign slush fund, going to help the friends of the administration and other wealthy interests? So who is actually exposed to the risk? And then coming out of it, who will have benefited from the tremendous amount of government and bailouts and help that, yes, do have a pronounced effect on the economy as a whole, hopefully a salutary effect, but that won't necessarily help those people who have risked so much, as your illustration describes.
Arnie, can you hear me? Let me interrupt. There's 4 minutes.
Okay, good. Thank you so much.
Make sure you know. Okay.
All right. So Calvin, but I'm hearing about, are they going to get more than a $1,200 check? Are they going to get maybe an extra $200 in their paycheck? You know, all those things. And yet what we've been talking about is a pattern and practice since the Civil War. What we're talking about is what's going on, for example, in Florida, where they basically said, if you are an ex-felon, you can vote. And then what did they say? But you got to pay off all your debts before you can vote. I feel like I'm talking about the Civil War again. You know, I mean, so I'm hearing all these storylines. And when you're looking at systemic racism, a check ain't going to cut it, Calvin. Right. It's not going to do it. It is so much more ingrained. The system is so rotted that it really does need to be looked at in a completely different way. And I'm afraid that they're going to come up with some sort of financial program that sort of sends a check and thinks they've said, okay, well, thank you. But in the end, they'll have a check for a year, but they'll have a continuing problem they've had their entire lives.
Actually, on that subject, Calvin, can I just ask you to articulate what they should do instead of
exactly
what Arnie just said?
Yeah, so being the academic I am, I'm going to supply a few footnotes first. There's a great new book by Kirsten Mullen and William S. Darity, Sandy Darity, called From Here to Equality, Reparations for Black Americans in the 21st Century, that has an outline of how to think about this, how to chart a path forward. Another stratification economist who I think has some fantastic ideas about this is Derek Hamilton at Ohio State University. He says, if we're talking about money, we're talking about tangible resources, and we're talking about the lack of intergenerational transfer because of all the processes that we've been talking about, why not invest in baby bonds for African-American babies that mature at 18? This would make up for that kind of predatory inclusion, the kinds of redline, the historic injustices, and we haven't even gotten to most of them, that have created this great wealth, this tremendous wealth disparity.
So Calvin, let me just stop you, because what I want to say is, you know what I mean? I mean, what I'm thinking about is what happened with George Floyd was that in 8 minutes and 46 seconds, we suddenly understood what we were told verbally. We've been sort of told in other ways for decades. But until we actually saw and had to watch for 8 minutes and 46 seconds, we weren't really sure that it was true about that kind of cop abuse. And that this. And what I'm trying to figure out is all the stuff you told me, in a lot of ways, how do you teach the American people to explain to them baby bonds are just the minimum of what we have basically taken away from generations of African Americans? They need to know this, because otherwise there's always this resentment. Oh, you're helping the welfare women, you're not helping me. Oh, you're doing this, you're not helping me. They have no clue to the kind of methodical disinvestment that has happened through policy, through practice, through redlining, through the kind of banking changes that we saw with these interesting products. And I'm almost trying to figure out, you can't do it during a campaign, but we really need to do it, Calvin.
Yeah, you only have 1 minute to answer that.
Good. So follow the money, and if you're wealthy middle class listener, go back in the generations and say, how was my family helped? Was it the GI Bill? Was it a generous mortgage? Right? Was it a leg up in the suburbs? Was it an open door to a university? And think about what stands behind that in terms of federal investment, state investment, really the kinds of subsidies that have helped grow the middle class over the generations. And then what would it have been like if you came five generations ago from some farming family that was not able to do that? What would the price be if you did not get that investment and that compound investment over those generations? And then ask yourself, how much would that be worth?
And on that note, I need to let you go. Good luck on this new book. I can't wait to read it. I'm taking copious notes. Derek Hamilton,
the other book, from Ohio State, I believe you said, and then there's that book, From Here to Equality. Thank you so much for joining us. This is a conversation that needs to be heard over and over and over again. And once we are armed with the facts and armed with the history, then the policy will be not only supported, but will be embraced. And that's what I want to see happen. Calvin Schmermerhorn is a professor at the University, Arizona State University, the professor of history. Thank you so much for joining us.
It was a pleasure, Arnie. Thank you.
All right. Stick around, everyone. We will schmooze tomorrow. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes.
Wake up, everybody. No more sleeping in bed. No more backward thinking. Time for thinking ahead. The world has changed so very much from what it used to be. There is so much hatred, war and poverty.
Time to teach a new way. Maybe then they'll listen to what you have to say. 'Cause they're the ones who's coming up and the world is in their hands. When you teach the children, teach them the very best you can. Oh yeah.
The world won't get no better if we just let it be. Change again, just you and me.
Wake up all the doctors, make the old people well. They're the ones who suffer and who catch all the tails.
They
don't have so very long before their judgment day. So won't you make them happy before they pass away?
Up. Just for the breath of life, I thank my maker. My mom say I come from hustlers and shakers. My mind building on skyscrapers and acres. He said, take us back to where we belong. I try to write a song as sweet as the Psalms. Though I'm the type to bear arms and wear my heart on my sleeve. Even when I fell in God, I believe. Read the days and weave through the maze and the seasons. So amazing. Feed them and raise them. Seasons are aging. Earthquakes, wars and rumors. I want us to get by, but we more than consumers. We more than shooters. More than looters, created in this image so God lived through us. And even in this generation living through computers, only love can reboot us.
Come on, wake up everybody, no more sleeping in bed.
Oh, wake up everybody, yeah.